This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Hello and welcome to Rabble Radio. I'm Megan Perry. You know, sometimes activism is like cooking. You add a bit of this, a bit of that, and hopefully the end result is something delicious. That's how I like to think about the idea called intersectionality. It's the ability for us to move beyond single-issue ideas and bring together new elements in the struggle for social justice. This episode, we'll talk to a couple of intersectional activists. First, writer Sharon Smith explains why intersectionality is important in her work and her writing. Jude Ashburn is an organizer of Rad Pride in Halifax and uses an intersectional model of activism to create inclusive spaces and create change on campus and across Halifax. And finally, this episode, if one thing can unite us all, it is our connection to the taxation system. And that's good. Stay tuned to find out why you should love your taxes. But first, we'll go back to intersectionality. It's a big word, and it has to be, because it's the idea we can unite our social justice struggles that it is impossible and unwise to separate them into single-issue campaigns. For activists, intersectionality is both a gift and a challenge. Sharon Smith is a feminist socialist activist and the writer of Subterranean Fire, A History of Working-Class Radicalism in the United States. She spoke about intersectionality at the Socialism 2013 conference in Chicago, Illinois. Rabble.ca's F-Word podcast was there to record it. Here's part of her address.
Intersectionality is a term that was coined by Black legal scholar Kimberlé Crenshaw in 1989. But what I want to argue is that the concept is not a new one. Black women have been articulately describing the multiple oppressions of race, class, and gender as experienced by Black women back to the days of slavery. Sometimes referring to this concept as interlocking oppressions, simultaneous oppressions, double jeopardy, triple jeopardy, whichever term is used, the point is clear. The term intersectionality caught on, I think, because it so brilliantly captures this concept. Now, what I'd like to do in my presentation is to discuss the history of this concept before Kimberlé Crenshaw coined the term, and Nikita will take over from there and discuss how the concept of intersectionality has evolved since the 1990s. What I want to argue here is that the concept of intersectionality is inherently progressive and is not only compatible with Marxism, but advances both Marxism and feminism theoretically. And the truth is that many black feminists and other women of color have been alienated historically by the predominantly white feminist movement. And that's part of what I want to explain here. But it's also the case, and this is, I think, important to the development since the 1960s and 70s, is that many black women and other women of color also felt sidelined and alienated by the lack of attention to women's liberation inside nationalist and other anti-racist movements. This alienation resulted in the creation of feminist theories by and for women of color that rejected prioritizing women's oppression over racism and vice versa, and also rejected middle-class strategies for women's liberation that disregarded the centrality of class in poor and working-class women's lives. Here, I'm going to be focusing specifically, we are, on black feminism, and this is not at all meant to belittle the many contributions of other feminists of color, which each bring their own unique perspective to this discussion and deserve the same attention. But in order to do, in this presentation, to attempt to do justice to the contributions of black feminism, which is a worthy subject on its own, which of course implies that I will do it justice, which I want to warn you, I won't. This concept of intersectionality was first given voice, I think, famously, by Sojourner Truth back in 1851, when she argued, "Ain't I a woman?" to the Akron, Ohio Women's Convention. And when she said, that man, quote, that man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it and bear the lashes well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen the most all sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? So Journer Truth is making the central point absolutely clear. While white middle-class women have so often been treated, and this is part of their oppression, been treated as overly emotional, delicate flowers, unable to make a decision for themselves, who must always keep smelling salts at their side. On the other hand, black women since slavery have been brutalized, denigrated, and subject to racist abuse. That is, their oppression as women is defined by racism that is a foundational element of U.S. society. Now, there's been a distinct tradition of black feminism that I want to focus on since the 1960s and 70s, that both analyzes the interlocking relationship between gender, race, and class that many white feminists tended to ignore at the time, but also demonstrated that women of color are not simply doubly oppressed. That is, it's not just two separate oppressions that are suffered, but actually black women's experience of sexism is shaped equally by racism and class inequality, and is therefore different than the experience of white middle-class women in key respects. In the 1960s, for example, when white middle-class women were being told that they should dedicate their lives to happy homemaking, so well documented in Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, black women were being blamed for causing black poverty and unemployment by experts because they regularly worked outside the home. In 1965, the U.S. Department of Labor issued a report titled The Negro Family, The Case for National Action, also known as the Moynihan Report, which managed to be at the very same time both colossally sexist and colossally racist. The report described, and I'm going to give a few quotes, described a, quote, black matriarchy, end quote, at the center of a, quote, tangle of pathology, end quote, afflicting black families, leading to a cycle of poverty. And this is the conclusion, quote, a fundamental fact of Negro American life is the often reversed roles of husband and wife, end quote, in which black women consistently earn more than their men, it argued. So many black feminists in the 1970s and 80s recognized this clearly. It wasn't black feminism wasn't simply a response to white feminism, it was a response to the racist depiction of black women in society and race, and also black women, black feminists. Many were veteran activists from the civil rights movement, from the black power movement, or even the Marxist left, and also embraced at the same time an anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist worldview. The black Marxist scholar and activist Angela Davis is probably the best known, but there are many other black feminists who have contributed greatly to the black feminist tradition from a consciously left-wing perspective. One of the most important examples, I think, is the black feminist collective, the Combahee River Collective, that was based in Boston in the 1970s. I just want to read from their statement, the political statement that they issued in 1977, which I think speaks volumes. We realize that the liberation of all oppressed peoples necessitates the destruction of the political economic systems of capitalism and imperialism as well as patriarchy. We are socialists because we believe that work must be organized for the collective benefit of those who do the work and create the products, and not for the profit of the bosses. Material resources must be equally distributed among those who create these resources. We are not convinced, however, that a socialist revolution that is not also a feminist and anti-racist revolution will guarantee our liberation. Although we are in essential agreement with Marx's theory as it applied to the very specific economic relationships he analyzed, we know that his analysis must be extended further in order for us to understand our specific economic situation as Black women." End quote. Those words, I would argue, are particularly relevant to us in the ISO today. Barbara Smith, who was a veteran of the Combahee River Collective and a very articulate theoretician in her own right, formed the Kitchen Table Women of Color Press at the end of the 1970s, and that actually spawned a whole wing of Black feminism around that press that not only embraced all lesbians, women of color, and working class women, but also consciously expanded the concept of what is now known as intersectionality to also include an analysis of the oppression faced by LGBTQI people, disability oppression, age oppression, and a method for addressing every other form of oppression experienced by women under capitalism. At the same time, this wing of Black feminism was not, Barbara Smith was not a racial separatist. This wing of feminism did not advance that as a solution to the problem. Barbara Smith stated in 1983 in a book that she edited called Homegirls, she said, quote, "The most progressive sectors of the women's movement, including radical white women, have taken these issues quite seriously," end quote. So the logic of intersectionality is not inherently divisive, as some would claim, but actually presents the potential to produce a unifying movement that fights against all forms of oppression.
That was Sharon Smith speaking at the Socialism 2013 conference in Chicago, Illinois. You can hear her full speech at the F Word podcast. It's at rabble.ca/podcasts. Just click the link to F Word. Dalhousie University made the news this year for creating gender-neutral washrooms, and that's just one example of success in activism that seeks to create safe spaces for trans people on campus. It's part of an upswing in community activism around Halifax for gender justice, which uses a model that understands that work for social justice occurs on many intersecting levels, such as race, class, sexuality, gender, ability, and more. Scott and I talked with Jude Ashburn, a queer and non-binary trans person who's worked for a number of inclusivity initiatives in Halifax. Ashburn has also been an organizer with Rad Pride Halifax, an alternative to the city's more mainstream Pride celebration. Scott started the interview by asking Jude about gender justice.
So why don't we talk first about the transition that South House is going to, and maybe a good place to start that is to talk about what is gender justice as opposed to other ways of approaching gender-related issues.
Gender justice, when I say it, I mean breaking down a binary notion of gender justice, complicating the notion of gender issues only belonging to cis women. It's intended to be more of an intersectional approach to feminist issues, yes, but feminist issues not necessarily just for cisgender women. So gender justice is about addressing all of the systems of social domination that affect people in gendered ways, centering the voices of people that are most affected by that.
What has that shift looked like at the institutional level at South House?
Going from a women's center and all of the events and community visibility, also the role within a university system, was huge. And it was happening at other women's centers around the country. There was this moment in a lot of feminist movements and departments, both in the university and in community levels all over the place, where I started really seeing that happen. the year that I convocated, our department went from the Women's and Gender Studies Department into the Interdisciplinary Center for Cultural Creativity. So the ICCC was our new department as opposed to the Women's Studies. Here at Dalhousie, you get a lot of older white feminists who really wanted the word woman to stay in the title. But we wanted to change the title to reflect a broader notion and for all genders. And just recognizing that there needed to be a shift in our feminisms to make this more representative of all the different people facing gender oppression. So we changed our constitution, we changed our mandate, we wrote a ton of new policies, some of which we're still writing and rewriting. We've had several community consultations where we get feedback and work that in. We actually define feminism and what do we mean by anti-oppression? What do we mean by these things? What are we just paying lip service to and what are we actually doing? And it was really just a way of reflecting on ourselves and becoming self-critical. You know, what have we done in the past? What are we going to need to do to change? And then, yeah, a new board came in, some new staff came in, and it really shook things up. So people had to meet new people and agree on a new name and agree on a new plan. And they did. And we had a lot of support. We've had a lot of great feedback. And it's just been an ongoing process. The next stage was really examine our events. What does Take Back the Night mean to us now? Are we going to do something like the Vagina Monologues again this year? And why or why not might we want to change those things up? And we decided to not do those events. We shifted around funding in terms of our events, coordination, in terms of our resources, in terms of our library and campaigns. We just took a step back. Instead of recreating the same events that we had done forever, events that were extremely cis-sexist and cis-centric and really only positioning the voices of cis white feminists. So we decided to shake that up and look at the same issues. So if this event is about sexualized trauma and rape culture, how can we do that while also being trans supportive and clearing room, stepping back to make space for people that we just haven't been listening to on an organizational level ever? So it was really just a process of checking ourselves and then coming up with new events. So the Rad Pride initiative was supported by the South House for this first go. You know, a little bit. We pulled off a week and a half of events with like $500, but it went extremely well. It was very well attended. And then we did a Rad Frosh, like an alternative orientation series in the fall, which was a month and a half of programming of critical education, looking at some of the tougher issues that students face and academic charity and things of that nature, and just getting folks engaged in the space and in critical learning and stuff. So we had some new stuff.
One of the things that seems to have happened in the last number of years, along with the increased openness in many critical or radical spaces related to gender, to being more intersectional, to dealing with trans issues, to dealing with race, along with that, there also seems to have been an increase in opposition to that from within movements. How do you respond to the line that often comes from some of those resistant voices about, well, yes, it's all well and good to think about different issues, but in losing specificity, we're really losing something important politically? And I mean, that's sort of a generous way of characterizing some of that rhetoric, but how do you respond to that line?
So that's an interesting question. I think that right now we are looking at something very similar at Dalhousie in terms of potentially changing the Gender Women's Studies course code, potentially changing the name of the department and disciplinary stuff. So I'm sitting on that committee and hearing some of those concerns of you almost get like an older women's club, right, who want their feminism acknowledged. They want the work that they did acknowledged. They want their funds acknowledged. They want all of that. And I get that. But I suppose I personally feel like the greatest achievement as an activist would be to like live long enough to see your work sort of become redundant. And I mean that in the best possible appreciative way. I think that it's okay to change and embrace change and let the people who are really wanting to come to the front, come to the front. So I think that that's important. But in terms of wording, I would like to see something like race, class, and gender studies, right? I'd like to see some cultural studies. And language is very important. So it's an interesting discussion that's going on right now. And I think that you can't obviously dismiss the category as woman. I don't dismiss that category at all. I often say women and trans folks, and I still do. I still deliberately do that. I don't wash over the fact that women, on a global sense, hands down, like there's a war against them every waking minute. And so I do use that category, even as a trans person who often got a lot of my issues erased because of that category. But I think it's still important. I like adding more words. There's always more words that could be added to things. And it's kind of interesting to get past these long acronyms and into, okay, we have to come up with new words now. And so I would love that. So yeah, I think that that's starting to happen, and it's actually kind of exciting.
That was Jude Ashburn of Halifax. You can hear more about Ashburn's philosophy and activism by tuning in to Talking Radical Radio at the Rabble Podcast Network. It's at rabble.ca/podcasts. Just click the link for Talking Radical Radio. Well, it's true that no matter where you choose to focus your personal radical action and who you are, you will probably end up paying taxes. And while politicians love to promise us lower tax rates and comedians love to joke about the tax man, there are economists across Canada who want to tell you why taxes are great. They gathered together for a panel hosted by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. The panel was excellent, I know because I was there. It featured Armin Yalnizian, Trish Hennessy, Evelyne Couturier, and Toby Sanger. You can hear the entire presentation over at the Needs No Introduction podcast at rabble.ca/podcasts, but we thought we would bring you a little bit of it here. The special guest speaker that evening was former Privy Council clerk and the author of Tax Is Not a Four-Letter Word, Alex Himmelfarb. Here's part of his address.
What in the world would compel somebody to put together a book on taxes? What would even compel you to come here when we should be watching the Canadians trounce the Bruins? I think it's because we know that a talk about taxes is a proxy for a bigger conversation. It's a proxy for a conversation about how we see our responsibilities to one another, about how we define the common good, if indeed we define it at all. I mean, simply, you know, taxes are the way we pay for the things we decide to do together that we couldn't do alone or couldn't do as well alone. It's simple. These are the things we decide to do together, and we have to pay for them like we pay for the things we buy as individuals. The approach that we take, the attitudes that we take about taxes then, tell us a lot about how we see the balance between private and public, whether we see the future as something we build together or something that we face alone. So taxes get at the heart of whether we in fact have a sense of the common good and see ourselves as connected to that common good and to one another. Now, somehow or other, over the last 30 years, something, as Larry says, something has happened to how we think about taxes. I don't want to pretend we ever loved paying taxes, and we don't love paying bills. We don't love, at the end of the dinner when they bring the check, that's not our very favorite part. But we know that we have to pay for the things we get. What happened with taxes? How did taxes become suddenly a burden or even a punishment dissociated from these public goods? And you can trace this. The catalyst for this change didn't start with Reagan and Thatcher. There's a long history of right-wing thinking that opposes government and taxes, but it crystallized in the 80s in the neoliberal revolution. You'll all know that that was a time when the rich countries and the Anglophone countries in particular were facing twin problems they hadn't seen before, problems of stagnant growth and inflation. This was a very troubling time for progressive forces. Progressive forces started to lose confidence. They started to worry, and you could see it among colleagues. They started to worry, did we overbuild government? Is our vision doable? And you could see a shaking in confidence in progressives that we're still paying a price for, and we'll come back to that. But this was also an extraordinary opportunity for the right to assert themselves, and they focused squarely on the two big issues, inflation and stagnation. So for them, they said, you know, the fight against inflation has to trump our commitment to full employment. That was a big transformative change. That's a revolution. They said growth has to trump social justice. We don't have to worry about distribution. Growth has to be our focus. The fight on inflation has to be our focus. I mean, when's the last time you heard a politician even utter the words social justice? That's like saying, hi, I'm a communist. I mean, those words are out of the game now. You can't even hear about it. You don't hear about equity. So they shifted from a concern about how goods are distributed to how wealth is created. Now, the forms of neoliberalism vary. They look different in Canada and the U.S. and the U.K., but they had they had a couple of things in common. One of them was that the solution was more market, more private. Let the market do its magic. And the problem was government. So government was the problem. And that vision that government's the problem and market's the solution, more private, less public, more individual, less collective, that vision dominated all political parties. You saw every political party start to transform their public policies. This isn't about partisan. You can talk about Harper. Well, no, you don't want to talk about Harper, but you can talk about all the political parties from the 80s. You know, who legitimized Thatcher in the UK? Blair. Who legitimized Reagan in the US? Clinton. The most devastating welfare reforms weren't brought in by Reagan, they were brought in by Clinton. Who justified the cuts and austerity in Canada? The Liberals. I mean, it's easy to pick out partisan, but everybody was infected by this neoliberal. Now, they had a problem. If government's the problem, the solution, of course, is to cut government off from the things that it needs. So you cut off taxes, which allow it to grow. You cut off information, which allows it to act. And you cut off trust and credibility, which allows it to innovate. So you have to squeeze the lifeblood out of government. Taxes, information, credibility. That's what you have to do. But there's a problem here. People in the post-war world came to love the services they were getting. In Canada, they loved Medicare. They still love Medicare, as inadequate as may be. They loved the notion that tuitions were subsidized. They loved the notion that sometimes the poor were given a helping hand. They loved those things. So you couldn't attack those things head on. You couldn't run a campaign to say, well, let's cut the shit out of Medicare. Let's blow up welfare. Let's drive tuitions through the roof. You couldn't run a campaign like that. So you had to say, somehow or other, these tax cuts were free. They're a free good. That we can cut taxes and cut government, the parts of government you don't like, you know, the bureaucracy and all this waste. And so, we could cut government, but we can leave the services alone. That I call that, in some ways, not only the big deception, but the big distraction. Because what that made us do is it focused us on big government. That's the problem, big government, big bureaucracy, instead of climate change, inequality, intergenerational inequity. This is like a magician's trick. Instead of focusing on the real problems that we can only solve together, we focus on big government. Now, how did they make this argument that taxes are free? Two parts to this. One of them is that we would free up the market so much by reducing taxes and getting government out of the way that we would generate so much growth and wealth that taxes would pay for themselves. That was the first line of argument. And you can see how well that's worked even in Canada. We cut corporate taxes, and corporations now are sitting on so much cash they could pay off the federal debt. They're not creating jobs exactly. They're not growing the economy. So I'm not sure that ever paid off. And in fact, the overwhelming evidence is that promise of so much growth to pay for itself didn't materialize, but the relationship between tax cuts and growth is an impossible one to make.
That was Alex Himmelfarb, former Privy Council clerk and author of Tax is Not a Four-Letter Word. You can hear the full panel, which, as I said, was excellent, over at rabble.ca/podcasts. Just click the link to Needs No Introduction. And when you get there, you will hear the voice of Victoria Fenner. She's the new executive producer for the Rabble Podcast Network, and next month she'll be co-hosting Rabble Radio with me. Welcome, Victoria. That brings us to the end of this episode of Rabble Radio. Thanks to all the contributors who helped put the show together. That is the F Word Collective, Scott Nye and Talking Radical Radio, and Kim Elliott. I'm Megan Perry. I'll speak to you next month. Thanks for listening to Rabble Radio.